Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there enough wilderness left for wildlife? As human populations expand and development of once open land increases, the world's native plants and animals are losing acre upon acre of habitat. Some biologists predict the extinction of millions of species by the end of this century. But conservationists are not willing to let that happen without a fight. They hope to protect life forms by returning the places they live and hunt to the state they existed in before human development began. Journalist Caroline Fraser explores the concept and the ways it's being applied in her new book, Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. Caroline, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
I'm going to start this by asking you to talk about what rewilding actually means.
Rewilding is a new conservation method that's been developed by biologists to try to restore some of our wilderness areas. What biologists have learned, and they've learned a lot in the past 20, 30 years, is that the system of national parks, which we really pioneered in this country, was a great system, but it actually wasn't enough to really preserve ecosystems and the services that they provide. And this you can see if you look at a map of the United States with just the national parks on it, is a really instructive exercise, because you can see then how very small these parks are in relation to the landscape around them. And they're also very isolated from each other, which is not a good thing biologically, because it means that species can't migrate, can't reach each other and establish a healthier genetic population. So biologists have been looking at ways to make our protected areas larger, but also come up with ways that we can live with wildlife more successfully and less destructively. So it's rewilding really refers to a kind of three-part concept, which they sometimes call the three C's, which is cores or big core areas, corridors to connect them, and carnivores.
So cores, in some cases, are those national parks or wildlife preserves. Is that right?
That's correct. They start with what we've got well protected, and then they try and look at the surrounding landscape. And it's not so much a plan of enlarging our national parks. It's more a way of seeing how we can mitigate some of the problems that we've caused through development and building highways.
So let's talk about corridors, because they're a critical factor, and they're one that might be easily overlooked by people. A lot of animals need to roam, and they need to sort of intermingle. Talk about how modern development makes that very difficult.
Well, we've really chopped up the landscape in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. and the way that we do that is through development, through agriculture, and through our own transportation systems like highways and railroads. And what that does to wildlife is that it makes small, isolated populations, which then become genetically weaker over time. So one way to mitigate those harmful effects is to find out ways for wildlife to cross highways or railways successfully. And this has also the consequence of cutting down on roadkill and on traffic accidents. So this has been tried pretty successfully in Europe over the years, because they're so densely developed there. They've come up with all kinds of different structures, highway crossing structures that can be put in pretty economically feasible way. And so they did this up near Banff National Park in Canada. With a few million dollars, they constructed some overpasses and underpasses that have very successfully allowed elk and wolves and bears and the other large species to cross those highways.
So obviously these animals aren't following signs. Can you talk about the kind of thinking that goes into how these passageways and bridges and underpasses are designed and constructed to be appealing to animals so that they don't just sort of take a shortcut across the freeway?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting phenomenon, because it is possible to study and figure out where animals like to go, where they want to move. And in some cases, it's very similar to the way people would choose a route. You know, if you're in the mountains, certain wildlife will choose the path of least resistance. But in other cases, it's not so clear. Scientists have been using some pretty innovative methods to figure out where animals are choosing to travel, including the use of scat dogs, who can be trained to find the scat of various species and figure out where they're really using corridors. And then they can plan accordingly and put these overpasses or underpasses where animals are more likely to use them. They've also used a lot of camera work, putting remote camera traps, they call them, in these underpasses to see how wildlife are using them and whether they're using them. And some of that footage is actually online and is sort of fascinating to look at, because you can see bears and so forth kind of approaching these things and checking them out and hanging back for a while and then kind of bolting through. and they actually think now up in Banff that some of the bears are teaching their cubs how to find these things.
So that over time, future generations will find it very natural to use these.
Yeah, I think so. And these things are now being planned in various places in the country. I know Washington State has some projects around I-90. And there are also, throughout the West in Colorado, I think there's some projects to get bighorn sheep where they want to go. So it's a very interesting phenomenon.
Can this work for smaller animals? As I know you live in New Mexico. Here in Texas, there's an awful lot of things like armadillos that end up, dead on the side of the road. Is this mostly for large game?
You know, I've heard of projects that are built to allow frogs and turtles to cross highways and roads. Particularly in areas where, sometimes there are phenomenon where a lot of these species appear all at once during the year and really need to get somewhere.
Yeah.
So I think that they're for all kinds of wildlife.
So, Caroline, the third C in this formula is carnivores. Talk about what makes them a particularly critical component.
Well, in the past few years, scientists have discovered that carnivores and the top apex predators in the food chain act as real regulators of that entire food chain, and that when you take them out, you see some pretty drastic unintended consequences. And this was seen pretty clearly in Yellowstone National Park. The wolf was shot out there for about 75 years and was missing from that ecosystem. And they started to have all kinds of problems that you might expect from an overpopulation of elk and deer. But there were also some other things happening that they didn't expect, which was some effects on damage to the aspen groves in the park, and a kind of deterioration could be seen also with fish species in the river. And what was fascinating was when the wolf came back to Yellowstone recently, those effects began to reverse. They're still trying to figure out what's going on with the aspen, but one clear effect was that elk were over-browsing and overgrazing, particularly next to rivers. And this was fascinating because wolves don't have a direct connection to fish, but it turned out they had a pretty profound indirect connection, because when wolves came back, they were really harassing the elk and the deer and keeping them away from the rivers, which are pretty dangerous places to be if you're an elk and there's wolves in the ecosystem, because it's easy to get caught there. So when the elk started leaving those riparian areas alone, vegetation started growing back and covered the water, which cooled the water temperature, which is actually really good for fish, really good for trout, because fish are extremely susceptible to small changes in temperature, particularly for their laying of their eggs and successful breeding. So this is just one example of the kind of top-down regulating effect that carnivores have.
You know what's so interesting about this challenge, Caroline, is that in theory, absolutely, I want there to be wolves where they belong in Yellowstone, but if I visit with my kids, I don't want them to run into one. Can you talk about why it's sort of a tough sell? Because we're sort of hardwired to fear carnivores, even if they don't pose much of a threat to us.
Yeah, you know, I think that the more that people learn, the more they can adapt to these issues. And while I sure hear what you're saying about the fears that people have about wolves, I think that there are real differences in the way that predators behave that we need to know about. And there's also, I think, a way in which we need to kind of adjust our risk assessment.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, it's very common now for there to be shows on television about, you know, sharks and how dangerous sharks are.
Shark week,
but I can
yeah.
tell you that in your life, you're probably more likely to be hit by lightning than to be bitten by a shark, unless you're you know, a diver and constantly going into the water in Australia or someplace like that. And likewise with wolves. With wolves, the threat is really just not there. There hasn't been a documented attack by a wolf in the continental United States ever, I believe. And wolves don't behave in a threatening way generally around people. I've seen the same thing with black bears. Usually when you encounter a bear in the wild, they run away mm-hmm. immediately upon seeing you, which isn't to say that these things don't occasionally happen. There have been occasional bear attacks that have killed people and mountain lion attacks. But I think it's a matter of educating yourself and your family about how to behave when you're hiking in a wilderness area or if you live in the Rockies. And there it's a matter of being careful with your garbage, you know, and just taking certain precautions. You know, you wouldn't go jogging by yourself in mountain lion country. That wouldn't be a good idea. But I think that these are things that are pretty easy to learn about and that we could really learn ways to live with wildlife without having to eliminate it.
Caroline Fraser is my guest. She's a journalist and author of the new book, Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Caroline Fraser. Her book, Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution, is out now in trade paperback. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I'm wondering, Caroline, whether you think national parks as they exist today are remote enough. It seems like another sort of irony in all this is that we're driven to these once pristine places by our love of nature, and yet our presence might, in fact, drive wildlife away.
Yeah, that's actually a great point, and something that has recently been better understood by scientists is what they call edge effect, which is that if you build right up to the edge of a forest or a park, you really start to see effects kind of creeping in. You see degradation to the land and to the services that the land provides. So they're trying to figure out ways now of making better buffer zones around protected areas and trying to limit activity in those buffer zones, including in places like Asia, which has a really interesting history of what they call community forests. Because of the kind of climate that they're in, forests do regenerate very quickly, much more quickly than here in the temperate zone of North America. But they've figured out ways to limit how people use those forests that surround their parks in places like Nepal, so that only at certain times of the year, for instance, can you go in and gather firewood or reeds, which are popular building material there. And that has been very successful because they've also compensated people for that by providing a significant percentage of the receipts from tourists visiting the parks goes back to the community.
You have a really interesting story in the book about a man from Nepal who was badly injured in a wild animal attack but turned right around and spoke up for the right of animals to exist where he had been. Can you talk about that?
Sure, yeah. This was a man who was a leader in Nepal, and he was actually working with his community in one of these areas where they were allowed to go in and gather reeds. He didn't see a tiger that was there in the hiding in the reeds, but was attacked by it. I met this man. He was very dramatic in describing how the tiger just hit him on the side of the face, you know, an incredibly powerful blow, which knocked his eye out. Mm. And he eventually did recover from this injury, although he did, of course, lose the sight in that eye. But he was a fascinating guy because he really understood and continues to understand, I think, the role of wildlife in the area where he lives, which is a pretty wild area in western Nepal. And I think he really values wildlife, as a lot of people there do. And this is very difficult wildlife to live with. Tigers, not only tigers, but elephants there present enormous problems to communities because they will get into the rice fields and, you know, in a single night, just a couple of elephants can do an enormous amount of damage to somebody's subsistence rice crop for the year. So these areas are really tricky for conservationists to work in because they need to figure out ways to preserve the wildlife while at the same time preserving the rights of the people who live there. And that has been very difficult. So community leaders play an incredibly important role in that effort. And that man was actually given an award, I think, by the WWF for his behavior following that incident. You know, they kind of declared him a wildlife hero, which in fact he was.
So in some parts of the developing world, this is certainly not widespread, but it does exist, people are realizing that they can actually make more money from ecotourism than they might make at subsistence farming. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is becoming very critical, particularly in areas in Africa where climate change is affecting people's livelihoods very in a very negative way. In Kenya and equatorial Africa, climate change is already having a very pronounced effect. They have had very serious droughts there year after year in recent decades, which has very much affected the Maasai communities and Samburu people, who are very similar to the Maasai. They're pastoralists who follow their cattle from place to place. And what they're finding is that during these droughts, they lose an enormous number of their livestock, their goats and cows and so forth, which is their living. And so they've in many places now, the organizations like World Wildlife Fund and other groups are working with pastoralists to try to figure out ways that they can reduce the number of livestock that they have, but also then develop the land that recovers from overgrazing as an ecotourism site with maybe a lodge or other facilities for tourists. And there's an amazing project in Kenya. There's a private rhino reserve called Lewa Wildlife Conservancy, which is actually where Prince William recently proposed to his fiancée. But at Lewa, they have really reached out to local communities to encourage them to develop their own ecotourism lodges. Lewa has several lodges, but they've really helped their neighbors, their Maasai neighbors, to develop their own lodges, and Lewa provides a lot of support for that.
Caroline Fraser is my guest. Her book is Rewilding the World. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak now to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Great show. One question I have. I know the national parks in the United States are a very small area, but we have a much larger area regulated by the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM. And aren't there a lot of protection laws there for wildlife? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, those areas are actually, you know, a point of real contention with conservationists because national forests and the Bureau of Land Management lands have a much larger mandate and much less protection than something like a national park. I mean, nobody can go in and, you know, put an oil drill in a national park. But on BLM land and national forest land and some of the less protected public lands in the U.S., they have a kind of much wider mandate and can do various kinds of development. There's a big controversy now in the state of New Mexico about the Otero Mesa, which is a very unique and biodiverse grassland in the southern part of the state. And as you probably know, there's a lot of oil development in that region as well, so and gas drilling and so forth. So there's a lot of discussion and debate over whether and how much the BLM should allow development on those lands.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, there have been repeated calls and discussions for an international park in the marvelous Big Bend region of Texas and Chihuahua. Given border violence, wouldn't it make sense to provide other economic opportunities for people beyond drug trafficking? And is there any hope for this to actually happen?
Yeah, that project is a fascinating one that I've been sort of following for a number of years. Conservation International, the conservation group here in the U.S. has been very involved in that, and it would be a way to significantly enlarge Big Bend across the Mexican border onto some private lands that have been bought by a cement company, actually. I believe it's called Cemex, which is one of the biggest cement companies in the world. And they have bought this land and are hoping to provide it for conservation. But the big question, of course, concerns the border and the fencing and other infrastructure that has been declared necessary along that whole region. So it's an open question, I think, what's going to happen there. But it's certainly been under discussion and planned for a very long time. I know that Bruce Barcott, is it, who used to be Clinton's Interior Secretary.
I want to say it's Bruce. Is it Bruce Babbitt?
Bruce Babbitt, yes. I'm sorry, I had the name wrong. But he was very involved in that as well. And that would be a kind of cross-boundary peace park if they ever actually do develop it. And I agree with the email that it could really provide some great benefits in terms of jobs and ecotourism, and also just, you know, peaceful relations between the two countries. And so that's one reason why peace parks are a pretty popular alternative now in areas where there have been disputes across borders. So I'd really like to see it happen.
There are not a lot of border disputes between the U.S. and Canada, but you do write about this really ambitious effort that stretches from Yellowstone to Yukon. Can you describe what's being done there?
Sure. That's a grassroots initiative that took as its inspiration the transboundary park between Glacier National Park in the U.S. and Waterton Park in Canada, which was the first instance, actually, of a cross-border peace park. And what Y2Y, as it's called, is doing is looking at conservation, again, on a much, much larger scale than we traditionally have. So they're looking at the entire Rocky Mountain chain, really, from all the way from the Yukon down through North America. And as with the kinds of highway and railway crossing structures that I was talking about before, they're looking at ways to mitigate some of the obstacles that we've put in the way of wildlife. And I think that those Banff crossing structures were a direct result of Y2Y planning. But I think they're also trying to do things like identify very critical areas that wildlife need, and trying to keep those areas open. So it's a way of looking at what are the needs of wildlife, what are the migratory needs, and how can we work around those needs and try to be sure that we don't put obstacles in their way.
So we know that animals don't recognize political borders, obviously. Sometimes this works to their advantage in places where the people don't really have much contact at all. Can you talk about the DMZ between the two Koreas?
Yes, that's a fascinating example of what can happen when people just stay out of, of an area, because the DMZ was essentially, by the 1950s, and the end of active hostilities, was really scorched earth. And, of course, it was heavily mined. It's a, you know, about a mile and a half wide corridor. And over the years since then, because it's so heavily mined and nobody ever goes in there, it has provided a kind of amazing example of recovery. Just natural recovery of a piece of land, which has become a haven for wildlife on the Korean Peninsula. Thousands of species of plants and animals are in there. They've been able to tell by using spotting scopes and binoculars, including some very rare wildlife like lynx and the Amur leopard and maybe even Siberian tigers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Kelly in Dallas. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Carolyn. Great subject. Thanks for focusing on it. I'm a conservation ornithologist, and I think the project you're talking about in the Rockies is Karsten Engelmann's project, the one he originally began, Y2Y. And although I'm not intimately involved with that one, I think that one's probably going to work. But I have done some work on the Trans Rio Grande project because it involves a species at work on the Kalima warbler. And I just want to tell you, right now, all the political signs are pointing very badly. It does not look like that one's going to come off just because of the pressures exerted by 911. But I was actually motivated to call by the anecdote that you shared with the guy in Nepal and the attack by the tiger. And I don't know if Chris is familiar with this, but about 10 years ago on a local lake here, Lake Arlington, there was a fisherman who was out fishing, and he saw a great blue heron who was trapped in a derelict fishing line, not his, but somebody else's. And he paddled over to try and rescue the great blue heron, and in the process of trying to unwind it, when the heron did become sufficiently free, panicking, attacked him, put its beak through his eye, and took out one of his eyes, just like the guy in Nepal. And similarly, this fisherman, this good old boy, said, hey, look, the animal was trapped. If I had it to do over again, I'd do the same thing. He wasn't trying to hurt me. He was just trying to protect himself, and that's the way it rolls sometimes. And I thought it was just amazingly, showed an amazing depth and breadth of spirit on that guy's part to react that way to the attack, and it reminded me so much of the Nepalese farmer that you were talking about.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. We're about to go to break, so we're out of time for this, but it's really amazing. Thank you so much for that.
Sure. Thank you very much.
I guess it's good to know, Caroline, that the Nepalese gentleman is not alone. There are lots of people who feel this way.
I think people all over the world are really realizing how important wildlife is.
Caroline Fraser is my guest. She's a journalist whose book is called Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. You can be part of our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Caroline Fraser. Her book is called Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. It's out now in trade paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Caroline, are there particular biomes that need more rewilding attention than others?
Well, yes, and in fact, and I was alluding to this a little bit in talking about the forests of Asia that recover so much quicker than our own temperate forests. And one amazing example of that is in Australia, where some ecological restorationists and activists are trying to restore some areas that were turned into wheat farms only a few decades ago, with fairly disastrous results, because Australia has a very, very delicate relationship between the native plants and the climate. Australia is very dry. It has a lot of salt in its ground that has accumulated from the salt winds off the ocean for eons. And so this restoration effort after these wheat farms essentially failed because the land just couldn't support that kind of growth are incredibly delicate and difficult to do, and yet has been so far very successful. So it's really interesting to see how the land can recover quite quickly in some cases, but takes quite a long time in others.
Are there places where well-meaning attempts at rewilding have failed?
Oh, sure. And I do talk about some of these in the book. There have been some efforts that I think have failed, not so much because of the inability of the land to recover, but because of difficulties in the relationship between conservationists and the people who live in the region. And one example of this that I talk about is in South Africa, where there have been a lot of difficulties getting some of these big transboundary parks off the ground, so to speak, because of poor relations and really a lack of communication between the conservationists who are trying to work on these things and villagers.
Because what they're ultimately doing, and you quote a conservationist in the book who says, this is really about managing human behavior more than managing wildlife.
Yeah, that's could not be more true and is a real understatement. We really have to figure out ways to give ownership of these projects to the people who live with them and who have to live with the consequences of them. That's only fair. For starters, and it just has proved true time and time again that when indigenous people and when native people have a chance to take these things over and run them themselves and plan them and organize them in the way that is best suited to their lifestyle, they just inevitably become more successful.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go back to the phones now, this time to Plano, and we'll speak with Bonnie. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm so glad that you're focusing on the human dimension, because I'm president of a local group called WildCare. We're a support group for wildlife rehabilitators in the urban area of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And we get calls all the time from people who are concerned about predators in the city, you know, coyotes, bobcats. But the situation we've got going on right now is actually about some barn owls that are nesting in the portico of a church in Plano. And, you know, we're getting all of these calls from people who are saying, oh, the church is so lucky. They're so fortunate to have these wonderful owls that do such a great job of controlling rats. Meanwhile, the church is saying that as soon as the juveniles fledge, they're going to barricade that area so that the owls cannot continue to nest there.
Hmm.
And I wanted to get Ms. Frazier's opinion about, you know, how to change people's perspectives on seeing these animals in an urban area as being beneficial instead of being a nuisance.
Wow, that's a great comment and question. It's a huge issue everywhere now in the West and all over the world. And I know that wildlife rehabilitators are really on the front lines of these conflicts. One species that we have here in Santa Fe, which you probably also have issues with in Texas, is the prairie dog, which every year there are, you know, conflicts that come up where people are afraid that they're going to get bubonic plague from the prairie dogs and want to eliminate prairie dogs from parks and so forth. I think it's education is just so critical, and I really wish in this country we could do a better job of working natural history into education for kids and for communities because, you know, as Bonnie was saying, these things come up all the time. And if people had a better understanding of what the needs of the wildlife are and how they could be accommodated, I think we would just all be better off. And one thing is just finding out what kind of species you're dealing with, which can be a really fascinating exercise for kids and for the community, and whether it poses a problem or not. Because in a lot of instances, the species may not pose the problems that are feared. Or there can be ways to work around it. Beavers are another species that's constantly causing various kinds of nuisance complaints. But there are often ways to mitigate what's seen as the damage. There are now these things called beaver excluders, for instance, which can be installed in areas where you don't want a beaver to come in and build some kind of structure that's going to flood a road, for example. So there are solutions to these problems, and I would urge people out there that instead of reaching for your gun or reaching for your trap, to call somebody like Bonnie and find out what is this species, what is it doing here, what does it need, and how could we maybe even live with it.
We have a question here via email about the effects of suburbia and urban sprawl. Can you talk about that?
Sure. It's a major issue all over the world because more and more people are moving to cities. We've seen massive migrations, really, to urban areas, which has presented both challenges and opportunities because it's actually opened up quite a lot of rural areas in Europe and so forth, where people have really abandoned some of the old agricultural fields. But we need to start looking at how we can best develop in a way that isn't going to affect, say, our watersheds and other natural areas. So we may need to look really closely at landscaping issues. I just did an interview online with a landscape association here in the U.S., which works with all kinds of, architects and land planners and so forth. And those are very much fields and experts who do need to work, I think, now with biologists in ways to plan development so that we don't really just have these sprawling, mega cities like Phoenix, I think, is a good example of something that has spread very widely in a region where there isn't very much water. And some good planning at the start might have really facilitated a better design for that city.
And I would imagine landscaping with native plants also would provide some food sources for these animals, even if a development has to exist somewhere.
Absolutely. I mean, here in Santa Fe, there's a major project underway to replant native vegetation along the Santa Fe River, which is a dry ditch most of the year now because of dams upstream. That's where the city gets its water. But we're trying right now to remove a lot of the non-native and water-hungry species and restore the native shrubbery and trees. And that can have a huge effect on restoring both the quality of the water and the habitat for wildlife.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Rita in Dallas. Hi, Rita.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question is about the area that your guest was talking about in the DMZ where there were a lot of mines, and so the area wasn't populated. Nobody went there. And so the animals repopulated the area. And I was just wondering, if there are mines all over, wouldn't that decimate the animals?
I've actually read something about that that said that very occasionally one of the heavier animals will set off one of those mines. But I think a lot of the mines are triggered in such a way that most of the wildlife doesn't set it off. So I think that's relatively rare.
You stress that we need to think about rewilding even when there isn't an immediate financial motivation to do so. Who do you find are the hardest stakeholders to convince?
Well, predators sure get people's backs up. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're talking about areas where there are significant ranching interests, for example, ranchers really are affected by predators and lose some livestock to species like wolves. So they need to be compensated, and there are, in fact, compensation programs in parts of the U.S. that will provide payments to ranchers if it can be demonstrated that a wolf took one of their cows. But, you know, I think that there's all kinds of other ways that we're finding out that we can live with these kinds of species. They're developing all kinds of things that will protect livestock. They're working with certain species of guard dogs and guard donkeys.
And, guard donkeys.
Yeah, and there are also areas where you can use this kind of fencing that they call fladry, which is a lot of flags tied to a rope that is alarming to species like wolves. Huh. So, you know, there are economic costs to doing some of this restoration, but there are also significant economic benefits. And I think in the future, restoration itself is going to provide a significant number of jobs.
Do corridors work to divert animals from, say, ranch lands?
They can do if they're appropriately designed, and I've talked to some experts who are doing the kind of work with scat dogs that I mentioned before to try and figure out, again, where wildlife is moving mm-hmm. and how they migrate, because the more that we understand about that, the more that we can avoid those areas and maybe consider not leasing certain areas for grazing that are heavily used by wildlife.
The last thing I want to ask you about is what we can do as consumers and as travelers to make good choices that at the very least don't interfere with rewilding efforts.
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that, because it really matters in places like South America and Africa and Asia. If you're making a trip there, you really want to try and find out who owns the company that you're thinking of traveling with. If you're getting a package tour, try and find out where the money goes, because a lot of the money for some of these package tours doesn't stay in the country or with the people that you're visiting. And there are now lots of options, like the place in Kenya I was mentioning, Lewa, and the various eco-lodges that surround it, where you're virtually guaranteed that the money you're spending is going to stay in that area and benefit the people who live there. And that's a really important step that you can take as a consumer to make sure that the money you're spending stays in the area and supports the people and the conservation.
The new book by journalist Caroline Fraser is called Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. It's available in trade paperback. Caroline, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.